agenda. Commission comments?
Comments? Commissioner Salzman. Commissioner Madison.
Oh, yeah. So on the occasion of the retirement of Chief Terry Hara, I think both Commissioner Figueroa-Villa and I were there, and I looked like there were about 600 people present.
Wow.
But it was really thrilling, moving, and I know the chief is going to be seeing more retirements of his command staff in the next couple of months, next few months, and so it'll be bittersweet saying goodbye to some of the deputy chiefs and assistant chiefs, but this one was really quite fun. A lot of Japanese drumming, Korean dancing, Japanese dancing and singing. It was a party. That's it for me.
Mr. Salzman?
Yes, thank you. I have one comment. I had the pleasure of speaking last Friday at the graduation at the Academy, of the Academy, class 11-14, something I always enjoy doing and very positive about. I do have, a disappointing report continuing regarding the department's ability to bring folks into the department, and I know this is a goal of the department, and members of the commission have been working on it with city department personnel and the department. But so this graduation, there were a total of 16 LAPD officers, which in and of itself is quite low. There were zero African Americans, and only one woman in the group of 16 coming to the LAPD. And it just I raised the issue again to remind all of us what a significant problem this is, and that I don't think these numbers could even sustain not only the total number of force that we have, but the diversity in the force is also significantly affected if we continue on this path. So I raise it and encourage my colleagues or volunteer to the extent I can be helpful to do what we can to turn this around.
No, I'm good.
We'll let the chief speak to that, but I had lunch with him yesterday, and it was one of the things we talked about, and there is a plan, and the both sides of First Street are involved in it, but it is not sustainable the way it's going, and that is an issue. I visited yesterday with our new Special Olympics LAPD division over at the headquarters of the Special Olympic Games, which are coming, the World Games are coming to Los Angeles. The world will be seeing us. And I went to look at a logistical plan of how we were going to keep it safe. And I came away with a plan of how law enforcement and LAPD and the sheriffs are going to be hand in hand with all of the athletes and all of the organizers and all of the communities around the country. And I believe it's going to be a really not only a wonderful games, but a wonderful opportunity to showcase our department and our relationships with these wonderful kids. And so I went to look for one thing, and I came home saying this is really exciting. Everything from the torch relay that's going to be all over the country to some of the events that are happening here in Los Angeles. It's going to be a proud moment, and I was very proud that our department has expanded its role beyond the policing role. This is community outreach in its finest, and it's going to be a national situation.
We do have two public comment cards on this item. We have Mr. Ted Hayes and Mr. Herman.
Morning, Mr. Hayes.
Good morning, sir. I sometimes wonder whether we're living in a sane society here downtown. Third floor City Hall has an evacuation plan in case of earthquake, terrorist plot, whatever. It indicates at the stairwell there is no exit to the roof. Use stairwell 5. On that same evacuation plan, it says stairwell 5, no exit to the roof. I've been working on this for 6 months. is still posted like that. I've contacted the fire department, everyone. They won't take it down. They won't revise it. What is it? So is the police department responsible for getting things posted correctly about how you can evacuate from City Hall in case of an earthquake or whatever else? Now, in that regard, I'd like to address your attention to our trains on the ground. They're called light rail. Recently, USC train hit a car, two coaches derailed. The safety director for MTA says if you put a train on the ground and people have to cross the tracks and drive across the tracks, you're going to kill them. But we're not like New York subway system, London subway system, Moscow subway system. We have no subway system. And the Crenshaw line does not go to the airport, despite the fact they lie and say that it does. But they're building that Crenshaw line, and it goes up and down five times before it gets to its destination at Imperial Highway and Aviation. And it never goes to the airport. The airport's a mile and a half away. So I mention this to you because I believe there's a public safety factor in the minds of law enforcement, and public is not being held safe by the politicians who lie and steal and corrupt our transportation.
Thank you, sir.
Morning.
Morning.
Just going to wake up feeling like Michael Englander from Council District 12 up there. But unfortunately, I would like to say thank you for supporting Special Olympics, taking the concern to address the real issue of how important and vulnerable our disabled people are in the state of California and throughout Los Angeles. It's about time we start to recognize and hear and listen to the advice by the public to secure our disabled family members. And so I applaud you on one good exception, but on another note, on the current news today with all the reporters here, we see another lawsuit coming. We already dished out $8.1 million for arresting someone. Very sad. Now, falsely, we're going into another subject of abuse, scandal. And we, you, the taxpayers, are paying for these lawsuits. It's time that this commission sit down and really take note with the people across the street at City Hall and ask them to listen. Is it that difficult? I keep my point very simple. I don't have to go irating and screaming out of my ears just to get anyone's attention. So I say to all of you today, address the issue of police violence towards people on the streets of Los Angeles. Address the real issues of our subways for safety. Address the real issues for minority African Americans who are categorized by some as indecent. So we beat them, kick them, slug them, taser them, and more so, our mentally disabled persons. Thank you and have a good morning.
Thank you. Item number two on the agenda, the report of the Chief of Police, Chief Beck.
Morning, Chief.
Good morning, Commissioners. This weekend, I attended the Police Memorial Run at Legion Park Academy. As you know, May is Police Memorial Month, remembering the sacrifice of so many for this city and for the cities across the nation. So there'll be a number of ceremonies, including our own memorial ceremony here. But this was the start of it. The reason I bring that up is there were three academy classes. That participated, ran on their own time. They're the three classes that are in the academy right now. All of them were larger than the class that graduated this past Friday. This class that graduated this past Friday was hired approximately 6 months ago before a new general manager at personnel department and before some of the other things that we have adopted recently were in place. So hopefully we will see the classes increase. And there is money in the proposed budget for hiring, although for the first 6 months of the year, first 6 months of the next fiscal year, The hiring is slowed down, so the classes will not be as large as sometimes we would hope. But the end of the fiscal year should make up for that, and we hope to be prepared with our hiring ability by then to augment personnel department. And if the commission wants to have a subcommittee meet with Chief Moore and discuss hiring, then I think that's more than appropriate, and I know we have done that in the past.
Great.
On to a couple of other things that are in the news cycle right now. The mayor's state of the city. He talked quite a bit about the police department. He brought up a couple of issues that I know have caused great discussion. One is the expansion of Metropolitan Division, and I'll discuss that. And the other is the creation of a division within the Los Angeles Police Department that consolidates many of our relationship building efforts and also takes control over the department-wide training and focus of these efforts. That division will be staffed by largely people that are doing similar functions in the divisions or in my Office of Community Relations now, so it won't be a huge drain on the field force, but it will be a fully developed division that will not only oversee our relationship building efforts such as the Community Safety Partnership, all of our social media efforts, our community relations sections in the divisions, but also the general tenor of how the police department goes day to day in the business of relationship-based policing. I'm looking forward to that. I think it's a piece that was primarily featured in the president's 21st century policing document, and I think that the LAPD will help lead the way on this. Expansion of Metro, just a little history. Metropolitan Division, at the time I became chief of police, was about 350 personnel because of the Great Recession and the change in the way that we compensate overtime. I had to reduce the size of Metropolitan Division. Currently, it was at about 200 personnel. The decision I made, and the mayor concurred, was to increase the size of the division by 200 to bring it to even a higher standard than it was 6 years ago. This will allow a greater ability to flex resources with its current TO of 200. Really, all Metropolitan Division was able to do was respond to the extreme crime spikes that occur in our divisions that suffer from the most violence. Typically, South Bureau divisions and Newton, with some ability to pay some attention to some of the other divisions. This will make Metropolitan Division more able to respond to crime issues citywide, and not just pay attention to the areas that suffer from the most violent crime. It'll also bring a huge infusion of younger new officers into Metropolitan Division. With them, they will help to strengthen the division's ability to build relationships with the community. They will all come from functions where community partnerships are very important, and I think it'll be good for the division. This also comes on the heels of us disbanding all the ad hoc crime suppression units that were created to fill the gaps that Metropolitan couldn't fill, such as the OO Crew Task Force, Valley Violent Crime Task Force, the same kind of task force that existed in West Bureau. All of those things were done by the Bureau commands as workarounds because they couldn't get Metropolitan Division assets to deal with crime spikes, and now they should be able to, and those assets will be better selected, better trained, and better equipped to complete their function. So I think that it is a good way to address our increases in violent crime, and that brings us to our weekly crime statistics.
Chief, one question on
this. Yes, ma'am.
Body cameras in relation to the increase in the Metro group?
As Metro will not be exempt, or has never been exempt from body cameras and or digital in-car video. They are just not in the schedule yet, but they will be. As body cameras roll out department-wide, they'll be supplied to Metropolitan Division. As a matter of fact, SWAT, which is a part of Metropolitan Division, volunteered to be one of the first entities to get body cameras in the new and next phase rollout of body cameras. So they'll get them first, and the line platoons will get them later. They're certainly not exempt. However, as you know, this next year's budget will not complete digital in-car video for patrol, and you know, we're hoping that we will get enough on body cameras that'll cover the entire patrol workforce, but Metropolitan Division is included in that rollout.
Great, thank you, sir.
I have a question for the chief.
Sandy?
Chief, so am I hearing that the 200 officers, or that this Metro Division will be trained, many of them will be trained in or have been trained in community relations or relationship-based policing? When you talked about historically, for 20, you know, we're years forward, so their training is different than what they have been trained.
Well, remember, these are
back in the day. Yeah,
these are all Los Angeles police officers. They're the same people that patrol your neighborhood today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are just taking a different assignment. They have all the training that the entire Los Angeles Police Department has had in not only bias policing, relationship-based policing, constitutional policing. Most of them will have, I'm estimating, 5 to 10 years on the job. Most of them will be hired, have been hired during the consent decree. Most of them will have been trained in an academy that addresses training in a much different way than it was in the past century. You know, these are not folks that we are recruiting from outside the Los Angeles Police Department. They are your police department. They are the police officers that you have come to respect and admire, and the selection process will help to ensure that all of those ideals are met. And I've had specific instruction given to the command to look for those things in the people they select.
Thank you, Chief.
Yeah. Effect on it. I'm sorry, Les. Or second to last, effect on areas like Venice or areas in the valley that have these, you know, that have different situations arise at different times of the year. Will this make us more efficient, do you believe?
Well, I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it would make us better.
Yeah,
and
I appreciate that.
And it will allow divisions that normally aren't able to get Metro, because Metro will be the first selection for Metro is to address violent crime spikes,
mm-hmm.
and some of the larger, more long-standing quality of life issues they haven't been able to address because of crime spikes. So this will allow more personnel to be able mm-hmm. to be flexed to those issues.
Yeah. Good. Thank you, sir.
If I could just follow up a little bit on Commissioner Figueroa-Villa's question. I certainly appreciate the explanation about the training, and I'm encouraged by that. I guess my concern, and perhaps this is what also animates Commissioner Figueroa-Villa's question, is Metro traditionally has had a culture, if you will, that is not I would not describe as community policing based, and it had to do with the particular tasks that were assigned to Metro. And so I appreciate the explanation, and I appreciate your suggestion that perhaps this will, in fact, by adding these younger, newer folks to Metro, itself have some effect on the culture in Metro, and I hope that that's true. I guess I do wonder whether there's something here for the Inspector General to help us pay attention to as both of these changes happen so that we understand how they are functioning and how they're working, since they are, in some sense, significant changes.
And Well, I would remind the commission this is just 2% of my workforce. It's an easy shift for us. The other thing is that stereotypes are always dangerous, and I think that much of the information about Metropolitan Division is just that, a stereotype based on long-standing and unchanged beliefs. Some of those beliefs based on facts, some based on fiction, all of them based in the past. The use of force per arrest rate for Metropolitan Division is below the average for the patrol force in Los Angeles Police Department. Their complaint per arrest statistics are below the average for the rest of the Los Angeles Police Department. They are a division that is well suited for their mission, and I think that some of the changes that we've made, you know, the new captain for Metropolitan Division just left a very, very busy area and is very attuned to community-based policing. Many of the lieutenants are the same. There has been a pretty dynamic shift. So I would welcome the Inspector General to look at the department's operations in any way the commission sees fit. But I would also ask people to do what we so often try to do for the rest of society, to have an open mind and to judge folks for what really goes on.
Yeah, I'd agree with that totally.
I have a couple of questions, and I admit to not being well-versed in how the Metropolitan Division is assigned, but I'd just be curious, Chief, because you just explained that there, when interacting with the public, there's fewer instances of, problems. I'm just curious as to whether or not they actually interact with the public as much as some of the other divisions, and I think when we get a report on how it's going, I'm happy to hear that one. The other question I have is, and I'm curious about this, because a few months ago what we understood was that there was some adjustment to be made in how some of the crimes were categorized. It was in conjunction with an LA Times analysis, some of which we acknowledged had some accuracy and some of which we differed with. But I'm really interested in knowing if what we're seeing now in this uptick in crime is largely attributable to the recategorization, or is it really that there are more violent instances occurring out there as a combination of both? I don't quite have a handle on what's happening. Is this largely due to different reporting of the crimes, or really more crimes, significantly more crimes are happening?
Well, as the commission will remember, the recategorization dealt with aggravated assaults, which is one out of eight Part 1 crime categories, and it dealt with aggravated assaults at what I would call the low end of the scale. In other words, the difference between a brandishing, which where no injury occurs, and its classification, and then changing that to an aggravated assault. So it deals with one of the eight categories. The other eight categories are, six of the eight are up. We didn't change any way that we categorized that. Shooting victims didn't change. Shooting victims have always been categorized the same way. That's up. You know, we have this is a real increase in violent crime. Now, there is some of it that can be attributed to change in the way that we translate California penal codes into the national standard for crime categorization, the UCR, but that is not the totality of it. And this is certainly a real issue that we are dealing with. And not only is it a real issue that the Los Angeles Police Department is dealing with, but the LA County Sheriff's Department is seeing an increase. The other major policing entities within the state that I have talked to are seeing an increase. You know, this is a statewide trend. Now, not everybody. You know, the sizes of police departments are differ vastly, and the resources within the communities they police differ vastly. So, you know, not everybody sees it, but the major metropolitan policing entities that I've looked at so far have seen increases.
Thank you.
So I didn't finish.
Yeah, sorry.
But I'll finish quickly. So the positive news is that homicides are down in the city, which is a great thing. Although some of the precursor crimes of homicide are up, so that causes me concern. Homicides are down 8.3% as compared to last year, and down 15% as compared to 13. So,
wow.
You know, that puts us on track to have historically the lowest year for homicides. Although, you know, we're just a third of the way through the year, so it's still soon on all of these numbers. They're not locked in yet. Rapes are up by 11.5%, and total violent crime is up 28%. Property crime is also up, and property crime is up a total of 11.6%. You know, as I said, as I answered to Commissioner Madison, we haven't changed any of the way that we categorize property crime. There is no change there to attribute these crime increases to. Nor have we changed the way that we classify robberies. You know, rapes have been changed, and not because of a coding issue, but because the UCR changed the definition. But we're still comparing apples to apples in that category also. That gives us so far year to date a total part one crime increase of 14.6%. On the personnel side, we're at 9,882 sworn personnel, 2,715 civilian personnel. I neglected to mention in my discussion of personnel that there is civilian hiring at certain categories in the budget, so that's a positive thing. We have 405 reserve officers, 371 specialist volunteers, 62 chaplains, and 6,081 cadets. And that concludes my report.
Chief, correct me if I'm wrong here in this line of thinking, because it's another thing that's sort of coming up as you talk about homicides down, but the feeders to homicides are
precursors.
Are up. Yeah, precursors. Yeah, which is. I agree with your concern. So this law that allowed the early prisoner release is being implemented, and there's a little bit of a lag time in that people have to apply and go through a process to be released, and it's my understanding there are multi thousands over 5,000 backlogged people applying for early releases now. And when you take that and look at the recidivism rate of 70%, are you, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like we're faced with a group that is being released early that has a high propensity to re-crime, which is two things. Number one, it's an effect on us, but number two, it shows how many the need right now for more programs for these folks that are being released to get back into society and get jobs and just general programs and philanthropy.
Well, you know, there's two populations here that we can discuss. One is the AB 109 group, which I believe you're referring to here.
Yeah.
AB 109's been in place for several years now. It's been in place during its initial stages during crime declines, general crime declines in Los Angeles and in the state as a whole. As it moves longer into its tenure, we're starting to see crime increases. And then new to this year, this calendar year, and 1 month prior, is Prop 47, which changes the way that certain crimes are categorized and prosecuted. You know, that also has had a large impact on who's in custody and who's out of custody, who's being prosecuted, who has who the state has leverage on to put into programs versus not. We've commissioned a number of studies as a profession to look at this, to try to because it is a statewide issue, we believe, to look at these issues and see if we can come up with a solution. I mean, obviously, we all recognize that California is not going to build more prisons, and that's not the way that the voters want to go, or doesn't seem to be the way the voters want to go. So we're going to have to look at various solutions and maybe come up with recommendations to tweak these one way or the other to have a more positive impact on crime in the community. I think you're going to have a presentation a little bit later on from Central Division. Captain Orb's going to be here. Probably Central Division is easily ground zero for all of this, because folks that are released from L.A. County jail just because of physical proximity are very, very likely to end up on Skid Row. So Mike and his senior officers deal with this all the time, and you're going to have a chance to talk to them. So I'll let them deal with it. I'll let them discuss it with you, because I think they may be the perfect people.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Okay, we do have three public comment cards. We have Prentice Jenkins, Mr. Herman, and Ted Hayes.
Commission.
Morning.
I want to thank the chief for having his officer handle that situation with the wand. I'm satisfied that the officer was not trying to touch my genitals. Also, I received a letter from the commission about the low-flying helicopters and the gay cops on the low-flying helicopters. He sent me a response, but it's from 2014. I'd like a response from 2015. Can you give that to the chief, please? It could say the same thing as long as it's from 2015. Post-traumatic stress creates things like this. That is a fire truck. It is a ladder truck. Gay cops continue to come by my window. Now, it had no lights on it. Gay firemen continue to come by my window because they're obsessed with my black genitals. There are a lot of gay cops and gay firemen in the police department and fire department. I actually convinced the commission because of the gay officer Jim Parker. He's a sergeant. So I proved that there are gay firemen and gay cops. What about the gay cops who are on the down low? What about the gay firemen who do this? Pass by your window 30, 40 times a day. What about the gay cops that do this right here? Continue to pass by your window, and these are the gay firemen passing by my window. They pass by my window. That is a floodlight. They hit my window with a floodlight at night. Why would you use a floodlight at night? You only use a floodlight when you're fighting fires. Yes. Because they suffer from post-traumatic stress, they continue to stalk black men's genitals.
Next.
Morning again.
Morning.
I hate to bring the bad news of Mr. Beck, but crime and the statistics of violent vehicle collisions to human beings has not come down. Just to remind you that it's Jose Weezer and that council up there that continue to give alcohol permits for what? Necessity and convenience, so that I can stumble off my bed and walk less than 10 feet to the next 7-Eleven or even the next bar. Because we built multiple towering apartments with all these little commentary cake and bake places for us to go downstairs and have a nice drink. I find that offensive. We become the hit-and-run capital of the world. Hollywood Highland, John Wall said it over and over and over, as I repeatedly say it to all of you. We become the hit-and-run capital of the world. And so, again, if we allow CD14, Jose Huizar, to continue to give out permits for alcohol consumption in the city of Los Angeles, yes, we will have lawlessness in this city, drunkenness in this city, and belligerentness, leading to more offensive, incomprehensible stupidity of humanity. Should the public fall into that disease of alcoholism and drugs because of Jose Huizar? That's a question you need to look into, commissioners. Stop the process of permit alcohol at City Hall. And yes, Mr. Soboroff, I love that finger because even I don't have to be offensive and rub my head with that finger. I just stroke my ear back gently like this. So I say to you, commissioners, ask the consul at City Hall, stop giving goddamn alcohol permits and making the public drunkenness in the public. Thank you.
The LA Times cartoon about the deployment of the Metro Division with the command officer cautioning against cameras and being recorded. I think it was a disservice when yesterday there was a verbal presentation on suicide by cops and that video they had. If it couldn't show the conclusion, because it's too ghastly, if the cops really had to take this suicide desirable victim, give a narration, but no O. Henry endings like that. Now, suicide by cop is something that's important. The chief never gives a statistical presentation on the number of people historically or even currently who were dying to die. And I think that's important. I think we should have a presentation on this so-called suicide by cop that was presented verbally. Incidentally, I'd like to hear that tape because I didn't hear what was happening. Anyway, the MTA says most of its victims who get killed by trains are suicidal. There was a police detective looking for a baseball bat on the tracks, and he was killed. He wasn't a suicide. And I think that's the case with most people. And as long as we as a city ignore the fact that when trains are underground, people are going to get killed, trains are going to be derailed, and it goes on and on and on, and nothing's done about it. I make this presentation to you because I think that this branch of our government at least ought to be concerned about what's happening on the streets and on the tracks. People are being killed, they're being harmed, and no branch of government is paying it any attention. We bury the bodies and we pay whatever the families require.
Thank you. We're now on item number 3, the report of the Executive Director, Mr. T. Fink.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission. For the public's information and the Commission's ongoing outreach to the community, we have another Police Commission community meeting scheduled, and that meeting will take place on Thursday, May 28th, 2015, starting at 6:30 p.m. It will be at the Shepherd of the Hills Church, 19700 Rinaldi Street in Porter Ranch, and our special guest that evening will be hosted by Councilmember Mitchell Englander. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. We do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Herman.
What day was that? Can you give me that back again? It was 26th?
28th.
May 28th?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have that down.
That's good. That's because of your outstanding staff that keeps you informed, sir.
Great. Good news. Thank you, Mr. T. Fink, for that awareness that we have Council District 12, Mitch Englander, participating in this ceremony. Hopefully we can remind them that drunkenness is not a part of a special event. Maybe after, when you're at home and you're less vulnerable to hit someone in a hit and run, that's more acceptable. But I find Mr. Englander offensive because he sits on two channels of a panel. He's on the public safety of the city of Los Angeles as a reserve officer, and then yet he sits on the council horseshoe delegating on behalf of the public's interests, who I find offensive and distasteful. But I'm not going to absorb too much of the time because I know I'm going to hold my time within this 1 minute. But I usually like to count from 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Batman.
Thank you. We're now on item number 4, the report of the Inspector General, Mr. Bustamante.
Thank you, Commissioners. I have nothing to report today.
We do have 2 public comment cards. We have Prentice Jenkins and Mr. Herman.
Again, post-traumatic stress amongst firemen and police officers is extremely dangerous. It's like giving those folks out there who are mentally ill talking to themselves on the street, giving them badges and guns. Can you imagine giving a guy yelling in the street badges and guns? That's what you get given here. And in the fire department, they're mentally ill and they're behaving. They're not actually behaving like children. Their mental illness has reduced them to the level of children. And they're like 12-year-old white girls, and I'm Justice Beaver. It's the truth. And there's a frenzy about it. And I continue to tell you that it's happening all over the country, and it happened here. Here is a police officer searching a woman. She takes her hand, puts it inside of her pants, plays with her butt, then turns her around, plays with her vagina, and she did it twice. They finally caught this cop and fired her and put her up on charges. I told you it was going on all across the country. That is not an accident. Nothing's going to happen to these people get involved. When they got involved with the priest abuse, the cameras got involved, and so I put the camera on the priest. Priests started going to jail. There are 850 priests on that list today that molested children. They say of all the children that didn't tell, there are over 50 to 100,000 who are in their 50s and 60s today who were molested. Nothing happened until the media got involved. You'll find a bunch of gay cops and gay firemen on the down low harassing. You may think that's funny. Everybody thought that was funny 50 years ago when priests were molesting children. It ain't funny today. 850 priests on that list. You won't believe how many cops you'll find on the down low on this list.
Mr. Herman.
Now, Inspector General, I brought this beautiful poster here because it holds up my notes. But you heard Chief Beck's report that proposed monies for hiring is going to slow down or reduce, when yet the mayor promised a rank-and-file 8% raise, which should have immediately began at 8%. Because on behalf of the public's interest, I, a stakeholder, wished Eric Garcetti, for the record, the mayor should have paid all the rank of officers here that 8% up front, not in increments. They work too hard. We don't need officers working overtime. They should be with their families, Mr. Inspector General. So that way, we're secured. They're less stressed. They're not going to harm us, taser us, shoot us in the back or something like that. You see? That would be respect for the people, reverence for the law. And then the report regarding what? Reducing personnel? Does that mean that the reports won't get filed on time? Like my report against Paul Koretz, who assaulted a constituent, Armando Herman, in a public meeting, standing at a podium? Come on! Really? And yet, Mr. Inspector General, don't you have something better to investigate, like why the city of Los Angeles continues to offer permits for alcohol beverages on a daily basis, like it's giving jelly beans out to the kids, like drugs that are given out to all of us in our streets? Not all drugs are bad for people. It's in the hands of those who use them the right way for their medical conditions, Mr. Soboroff. Let's not get contemptuous with anyone here. I'm just being open-minded. I'm not offended by gay policemen. or anyone else. Thank you.
Thank you. We're now on item number five. Item number five consists of information items and filed items relative to noise variances and special event permits submitted for the period ending April 17, 2015. Item number six, presentations. Do we have any presentations?
Yes, we do. Mr. President, members of the Commission, you have a presentation by the Chief of Police, Chief Beck.
Thank you very much, Commissioners. You know, I'm going to bring up Mike Orb, our captain of Central, but first, and he's going to introduce some of his officers, and they also have a presentation they want to make via video. But first, I want to say a couple things about Central, and particularly about Skid Row. You know, I've policed this whole city. I've worked every division in all 21 divisions in the city. I've been all over it for the last 40 years, and day in, day out, night in, night out, Central Division is the toughest assignment in the city, and it's because of Skid Row. The officers that work Central Division, particularly the ones that dedicate themselves to working the row, have tremendous hearts. They do it as volunteers. They do it because they want to make a difference, and I think they're tremendously special people. Then I wanted to recognize a few of them today. You know, I went out right after the officer involved shooting that was so widely publicized. I went out and walked with Officer Joseph for a while and looked at some of the conditions that they have to deal with every day. And even though I've done it many times before, I hadn't done it recently, and it brought home to me just how tough the problem is and how intractable it's become. So I wanted them to come here so we could recognize them for their great job, and also so that the commission could hear from them and develop a little empathy for the things that they face every day. Mike, I'll let you run it from here.
Thank you, sir. Commissioners, thank you. I'd like to introduce Officer Delano Hutchins, Officer Andre Lanier, and Officer Dion Joseph. Come on up, guys. The Skid Row area of downtown is defined as 3rd Street to 7th and Main Street to Alameda. It's a small area, but it's a very busy area. Skid Row has the largest homeless population in California. Some of the residents that live in Skid Row are parolees, they're on probation, sex offenders, drug addicts, and mentally ill. So we have a big cross-section of crime in that area. But there's also a large number of people who are there generally to seek services and get help. And we cannot forget that. The last numbers that we looked at, and these numbers change, but the sheltered population could go up as high as 3,000. And the unsheltered can go up to 1,900. So these numbers change depending on the conditions, but it's a very dense population.
Sheltered, you mean within buildings? Within the service providers?
Yes, facilities? Sir. The okay. SRO hotels, the temporary shelters in the missions.
Sure, okay.
The officers, their primary assignment is to walk a footbeat in the Skid Row area. The commission brought up community policing and how important community policing is. As you could imagine, with an area with a population that is engaged in some criminal activity, it's also important to balance it out, that we put a face with the police officers and not just an enforcement angle. These officers do that on a daily basis. Some of the things they do is they focus on community relations to create a greater interaction with the homeless population, where they're actually going out and meeting and talking to people every day. They become familiar with our officers. They work a 10-hour shift, and the majority of that shift is on foot. Most of the day, they're walking the beat and talking to people that are physically living on the streets or in their shelters also. The goal is for them to build the trust in this community. This is a very important piece. Again, as I talked about, having a strong enforcement in that area could create some negative outview for the officers, for the community. So what's more important is that they know their officers that are working in their area. These officers have fostered an environment within the homeless population that encourages them to speak out and actually report crime, where these crimes may have been unnoticed before. They fostered the relationship with our SRO hotels, with our missions, and they've created some great communications. This is important because if they see that person that is out in the field and they do need help, they're able to make a phone call on many occasions and get them emergency help. So this is very important. Officers Hutchins, Lanier, and Joseph strike a unique balance between enforcement and outreach. And as you will see on the video, they do so with compassion, commitment, and leadership. Thank you.
Are we going to see the video now?
We hope so.
Senior Lead Officer Deion Joseph. I've been working in Skid Row for 17 years of my 19-year career with the LAPD.
My name is Officer Delano Hutchins, and I've been working in Skid Row approximately 4 years of my 5.5-year career with the Los Angeles Police Department.
I'm Officer Andre Lanier. I've been working on Skid Row for 5 of the 6 years I've been employed here at LAPD.
We knew the community wasn't going to come to us, so we had to go to them. And when we did that, and we kind of broke the back of the criminal element and made it safe for people to come to us, things began to change.
He cares. When I say he cares, he truly cares. And it's not like a person come here and go to work for 8 hours, 10 hours. He cares, and that's good.
I know from when I was out here on the street. It was hell, but he helped me get through it because I was on drugs. And now I got sober. I'm going to embarrass Hutchins. He's fine as a mother. He helped me, Hutchins, and his partner.
They don't just police the people now. And they know how to, you know, communicate with the people. They do a great job now. And I say that because, to me, I've just watched them grow. And one of the most important things is knowing how to help someone. Because the people in our community need help. And finding out how to help them is what's important. And they figured it out.
This is a community is built up of people that are in this situation. They didn't ask to be put here. But thanks to these officers single-handedly walking the patrol, protecting the people here of difficulty, and I thank God.
They're all my favorites. When I have a problem, I go and find one of them. They help me take care of the problem.
When I have a person who lives in Skid Row fighting some type of sobriety, to see them 3, 6, 7 months later, and now they're sober, and they thank me for it, and I basically tell them it wasn't me, it was their will to wanting to get better, my assistant that helped them do it. That's what I get out of it. That's satisfaction I get.
Seeing people that want to do better, and they just can't, then the fact that I can actually come and then connect them with some form of resources here, it does a lot for me. It makes me feel good.
They'll ask me if I'm all right and everything. I said, yeah, I'm just getting old. I'm 70 years old, April 3rd. I'm tired of living in Skid Row. I'm tired of it. I want an apartment again. And so they try to help me.
Wonderful.
So
gentlemen, we have
the only thing I would ask is, you hear a lot from me about this stuff, and you hear from the captains, but this is an opportunity that the commission has to ask three officers are out there every day, all day.
Yeah. Yesterday I drove it. I've been involved with the Weingart Center for many, many years from the service provider side. And yesterday I drove it, and I saw a little bit of what's on that video, but I saw a lot of problems that aren't. And it doesn't take a sociologist to see what they need goes way beyond housing, way beyond housing. It's mental health services, it's health care, it's substance abuse services, and it's a lot of it is proactive services and programs so people never get in those situations in the first place. But saying that, what you do see on the video and what you do see with you guys, because you've been all, you know, all over the news lately, and it's wonderful, is you're protecting many unfortunate people who happen to be there. And you're doing it with such compassion and such honor. It makes us really proud. Really proud.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
We're going to give you guys some accommodations, you know, but do you want to get those first? Because maybe if you say something that would cause us not to give the accommodation.
Sir, first of all, I promise I won't say anything because I'll be in trouble.
Commissioner Kim's got a question.
I'm so inspired by your work. And so for anyone with such commitment as you have to this community and your work, I would just like to know what continues to motivate you in light of the challenges that you face every day?
Well, I think what continues to motivate all of us is that period when you come in contact with somebody who you initially look at and you would say, there's no hope for this person, but then you take that extra step, you know, to think outside the box and say, you know, what if this was my aunt? What if this is my mother, my sister, or my cousin? And sometimes in Skid Row, there are people who are my aunts, my cousins. You think, you know, what would you want somebody to do for them? And that's go the extra mile. So we do that. And then you may not see that miracle there. But a year, 6 months down the line, that person is now in a drug program. And they come back to the station and say, hey, I want to talk to you. You're the reason why I've changed. You're the reason why things are different. You know, it's everything we're about in downtown LA with every police officer is about creating an environment that's conducive to change, so that the influence of the drug programs and the service providers there can have a stronger influence over the community than the criminal element. And we just need support in doing that. And we know we have a lot of support from our bosses and our leaders and from the commission, but the badge is not a panacea for all the ails. And just like you stated, there needs to be housing for the homeless. There also needs to be proactive outreach to the mentally ill, who are routinely victimized and also, unfortunately, suspects in crime. Those would be key. But Skid Row needs to be an environment. If there's a drug program, you can't have drug dealers hanging around it. And that's why we walk the footbeat every day and do the best we can to deter it, even with a lot of hindrances. But we're not going to stop because Skid Row is like our family. I do consider them like my family, and so do these officers at Central Division.
Your empathy and compassion is really inspirational. In your time working in the Skid Row community, have you seen any positive changes, you know, sort of more systemic changes in the community? That
what I can say is from 2006 to 2010, we came close to giving the people of Skid Row that environment. It's what the community wanted. They wanted clean, safe, healthy streets. We had got reports from drug programs and presidents of missions saying we have less weapons, we have less drugs coming in our community. We can walk down our sidewalks and not have a bunch of drug dealers tell us to go stand in the street like it's the Jim Crow South. We can walk and not walk past a pile of garbage and have to be reminded of failure every day. And we gave them that. Unfortunately, there are some hindrances to that, but I always say the one victory that no one can take away from any of us, and I'm sure my partners here will attest to it, is the relationships we've established. We can't do the things we used to as it relates to making crime, keeping the streets safe. But what's happening now is people who are less afraid to tell me, officer, that guy raped me last week.
Yeah.
Officer, this guy stabbed that guy you're looking for, who stabbed that guy, he's over there in that tent over there.
Yeah.
And that's something no one can take away from us.
911 calls from within the community.
Yes.
Because the people want to be protected against others in the community.
And they trust us. That's the thing. They trust these officers, you know, with this information, and we mm-hmm. come through. We come through.
Yeah. Guys, come on up. Let's do these. Let's do the presentations. I see that Craig Lally's in the house. He's the head of the Police Protective League. And Craig, will you come up and do this presentation with us? Chief? Gentlemen?
Yes, sir.
Come on up. Andres?
Are you the one who's called the fine?
No, that's
not. That's a sexy one. That I got that right.
Sometimes they say some things.
It's okay.
Did I do this wrong? Did I go backwards?
Yes.
Members of Los Angeles Police Commission congratulate all of you on your commitment to improving the lives and residents of the stakeholders in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles. In 2005, the Los Angeles Police Department launched the Safer Cities Initiative to address quality of life issues in Skid Row area of downtown. SCI assigned 50 officers to work full-time to police the 50-block area. Today, there is one lieutenant, seven sergeants, and 50 officers. SCI works in conjunction with LA Homeless Service Association, LA County Department of Health, to provide direct services to the residents of Skid Row. The LAPD has established lasting connections with the community and religious leaders and service providers in improving the dialogue between the LAPD and the homeless. The Safer Cities Initiative is not just about crime reduction, it is about improving the quality of lives of the homeless in the area and improving the department's relationship with involved parties in Skid Row. Our officers' focus has been to act as the liaison between the department and the community, directing our efforts at improving those relationships has proven to be your continuous goal. You've been instrumental in improving the lives of those you have touched by keeping open the channels of communication and bridging the trust between the homeless and local community leaders. Your specific involvement has garnered the attention of everybody. you guys are cool. I mean, what do you want? Your diligence and attention to duty truly reflects our department's philosophy to protect and serve. For this, we thank you for outstanding contribution to the city as a member of our Los Angeles Police Department, awarded 21st Day.
Thank you. I meant everything I said. This is a tough job in any circumstance, but the job you guys do is that much tougher.
Great.
Thank you, sir. I saw them on YouTube when they were getting honored by Isidore Hall. That was unreal. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, gentlemen.
Can we all move over this way just a little bit so we get a group shot? Can you guys all move over that way a little so you can center it? Please.
You want to go over here. Are you guys in?
Yes.
Are we all in?
Okay, on the count of three. Okay, one, two, and three. If I can do two more, please.
Come on.
Oh, that's nice.
One, two, and three. Good. One more time, please. And one, two, three.
Thank you.
Well, we do have one public comment card. We have Mr. Ted Hayes.
Great work again, John. This is a long overdue commendation. As I mentioned some time ago, Officer Joseph would be the first face on the Skid Row Mount Rushmore. All right. He is the icon of police activity in Skid Row. I've noticed this officer for years and years. As I pointed out, I tried to spend a month downtown sleeping on the sidewalk in Skid Row. I couldn't do it. I was either going to get killed or kill somebody, so I left. But Joseph stands out in everyone's memory and everyone's recognition downtown Skid Row and the work that he and his colleagues do. I appreciate the board for bringing them here, giving them the accommodation they've given them, because they deserve it. Now, the real villain at Skid Row is street services. One man's trash is another man's treasury. And street services despite the fact that the courts keep saying you can't do that, they do it anyhow, anyway. And so I'm thankful that there's some effort to try to retain the goods, plastic bags, shopping carts that the homeless have, because, as I pointed out, homelessness really, in my mind, is a culture. Some people will never get housing. Some people will never leave our sunny and warm sidewalks in Los Angeles. So that's a fact. Gentrification won't end it, nothing won't end it, and that gentrification is a clash for years to come. Not only are the high rises being converted, the homeless community is building in Skid Row also. They intend to stay there, and they will be there, and perhaps we can find solutions, remedies, or just modifications, but it will never end, I can assure you.
Thank you. We're now on item number 7, consent agenda items. These items are considered to be routine and non-controversial, upon which the board is provided with adequate information for approval without inquiry or discussion. We do have a comment card on 7A. Would a commissioner wish to pull 7?
I move approval of item 7B.
We have a second? Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. 7A, we have Prentice Jenkins.
Thank you. You know, we all have a public life, a private life, and a secret life. Matthew Phillipson, Captain Matthew Phillipson, fire chief, had a public life. He's an excellent fireman. His private life, he was married. His secret life, he was a heroin addict. He got caught buying 7 balls of heroin, so don't tell me firemen are not on drugs. He got caught taking 7 balls of heroin.
This has nothing to do with
it. It has everything to do with heroin, because it has everything to do with police. You're
talking
about.
Stay on topic or come back during public comment.
Sir, it does, because you're issuing firearms to people who are killing people on Skid Row. I mean, if those cops that you just showed us had run into Africa, he'd probably be alive today. You had the wrong cops run into Africa. If they are what they say they are, he'd still be alive today. Those should have been the ones that encountered him. So I'm saying, when you start issuing firearms to mentally ill people, and you have a lot of mentally ill cops, they've seen a lot of death and blood.
Mr. Jenkins, you have to stay on topic.
Sir,
that's
if you
not
just
the
let
topic.
Me talk,
that
I'd
is
be
not
done.
The topic. I
this
understand.
Is the topic. You've issued firearms.
That's not what it says. Read it.
This is about firearms, isn't it? 7A is about firearms.
Read the agenda
Albert
item.
Farrow,
if all you had to do was let me continue, and I'd be done.
No, that's not the way it works.
There.
You need to speak,
sir,
on topic.
I'm saying you have a lot of mentally ill cops. You have a lot of mentally ill firemen.
This is
and
issuing a sales
people.
Permit. You either have to stay on
sales
topic
permit.
Or
there
come
you go.
Back.
Why are you?
Why don't you sit down?
Why don't you sit down? I'm the public. Why would you have me sit
because
down?
Because your
now?
Turn to
all
say
you had to
this
do was
isn't
let me,
here yet.
All you had to do was let me talk. That's all you had to do. Now you got to put it
down.
20
next,
minutes
next.
Down.
Come back during public comment.
Next.
Thank you.
Let's have a motion for approval of 8A.
7A.
I move approval item 7A.
I'm sorry, 7A.
Okay. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We're now on item 8, regular agenda items. 8A and 8B are verbal presentations. Would a commissioner wish to pull an item as special, 8C through 8E?
Nope, I'll move approval of items 8C, 8D, and 8E.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, let's have the verbal presentations.
Thank you. 8A, Department's verbal presentation and discussion relative to the first quarter 2015 risk management report.
Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, commissioners. As you know, I'm Arif Ali Khan, and I'm seated next to Mr. Michael Himes, our department risk manager and the commanding officer of the Risk Management and Legal Affairs Group, and we're also joined by Captain Dominic Choi, the captain commanding officer of the Risk Management Division. We are here this morning to discuss our first quarterly report on our risk management harm reduction strategy. As you may recall, back on February 17th, about 8 weeks ago, we presented the chief's written report unveiling our strategy and how to deal with a number of areas in reducing risk and reducing harm in particular for the department, the public, and of course the city. Since that time, we've had a very positive reaction to our report. We have had many inquiries from other departments, other cities, other law enforcement agencies, academic institutions, and others, because we did make sure to widely distribute this to get their feedback and comment, because we constantly want to reevaluate and see how we go forward. This is our first quarterly report, and what we thought we would do today is give you an update on the progress of our implementation. As you may recall, we had a timeline at the end of the presentation last February, as well as some other developments since we unveiled the strategy. And also, for each of the quarterly reports, as I think I mentioned, we wanted to have one focal area in one of the four areas so we can take a little bit of a deeper dive into a particular subject. And today, what we'd like to do is work-related injuries or workers' compensation.
Good.
Especially in light of the controller's audit that was released just a few weeks ago. Just as a quick overview of our overall strategy, of course, we are shifting away from sort of the speculative risk approach that was somewhat complex and really looking at specific harms. Who are we hurting and how is that happening? And really focus on looking at the data to determine a root cause and do so by working with others throughout the department and outside the department on what we can do to actually solve real problems and looking at specific interventions that have the most significant impact and then being able to measure that impact rather than just assuming that it's having some impact without any feedback to that. Specifically, we're looking at reducing three types of harms. And every time we're looking at a particular issue, at a particular problem, we are always going to be evaluating against these types of injuries. First, physical. And as you can see, there are injuries, physical injuries, whether it's to employees or members of the public, and injuries, et cetera, from a traffic collision or use of force. Organizational injuries, which is probably the one area that usually doesn't get as much emphasis, is what is the impact on the organizational effectiveness, and that sometimes we have to incur risk of litigation or other things because it has an impact on LAPD as an institution and its reputation in the community, and especially the public trust. And then, of course, financial, and that could be anything from medical costs to equipment costs, and then, of course, litigation. And based on that criteria, as you know, we came up with the four focal areas of uses of force, officer-involved traffic collisions, work-related injuries, and workplace misconduct, and each of the different injuries that apply. And also, once again, focusing on what we call the tactical harm reduction. As I mentioned before, you have to say tactical before everything at the Los Angeles Police Department gets everybody's attention, and here it does. Now, today, when we talk about some of the things we put in place, especially since it's the early phases of the implementation of the strategy, it's probably more suited on the strategic or operational level in terms of the infrastructure and some of our data analysis. But as we develop and as Captain Choi and Mr. Himes will talk about, it's all to build the tactical interventions and the tactical dimensions in terms of problem solving. And using the operators is a really major shift, and not make this a top-down approach, but really look and talk to and get the ideas from the people who are actually in the field dealing with these. And just, once again, the sort of metaphor of untying the knots. But of course, first we have to figure out where the knots are, how big the knots are, and how we can come up with some problem solving. And utilizing the available data, root causes, collaborating, the appropriate measures, and then providing the support for that problem solving approach. Organizationally and structurally, before I turn it over to Mr. Himes, I do want to just mention something that's not directly related to risk management, but it's the renaming of what used to be called the SACP, or the Special Assistant for Constitutional Policing, and the Chief's decision to elevate it to an actual office, to the Office of Constitutional Policing and Policy, to reflect all of the things that the folks on my team work on. Also, SACP tends to define the entire organization by an individual, which is me, which it really shouldn't be. It should be for all the things that we do. And as part of that, if you look at the blue on the left side, we've renamed IAID, internal audits and inspections division just to audit division. Their focus is on audits that meet the generally accepted government auditing standards and leaving inspections, reviews, spot checks to other entities, especially in the divisions. Also, PRD, known as Planning and Research Division, that actually doesn't focus on either planning or research. We thought it would be a good idea to reflect the important work that they do, which is really the coordination of policies and procedures, and renaming that. And then the Risk Management Legal Affairs Group. On the renaming and the reframing of this, this is all effective as of Sunday in DP5, and so we're encouraged as we move forward. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Himes, who will talk to you a little bit about the new Risk Management Legal Affairs Group and what has happened since we last spoke.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Since our last meeting in February, we have completed several structural changes that we believe will help facilitate our execution of our harm reduction strategy. Probably as an overview, we have created the Risk Management Legal Affairs Group to bring together both the things that precede litigation and the litigation to try to make it more of a seamless process, so where we can engage in prevention, intervention, and then if it does result in litigation, that hopefully we are able to mitigate or reduce our exposure in that area. As part of that, we've also brought over the Ombuds Office from the Employee Relations Group, which we hope will help us, especially in the area of workplace conflict, to provide some training, some prevention, some intervention to help reduce those and lead to early conflict resolution, which again we hope will reduce our litigation exposure. But most importantly, we've created a risk management division, which is under the command of Captain Choi. And as part of that, most significantly, I think, within that risk management division, we have our risk mitigation unit, which is comprised of our four problem-solving teams in the four areas of harm. So each problem-solving team is comprised of two sworn officers and supervisors. And, their goal is to go out and seek out the experts, the operators, develop the harm reduction strategies that we're able to implement, then throughout the organization. The problem-solving teams are very important because what they're going to do is they need to have liaison with a very key component, and that is our risk management coordinators, which are going to be at each geographic area. It's a very large organization, and to roll anything out throughout the organization requires a point of contact so we can have the free flow of information, communication, the identification of problems, the ability to develop additional data, and we think the risk management coordinators are a key component in that. With the support of the Office of Operations and Chief Villegas, the intent is to have a supervisor assigned at each geographic area. Now, to actually accomplish that in one fell swoop would be a monumental task and would probably lead us to potential problems as far as our ability to be successful there. So what our proposal is, and again in cooperation with the Office of Operations, is to pilot the risk management coordinator functions within a few divisions to begin, a couple at Central, perhaps one in the Valley. The responsibility of the risk management coordinator is to make sure that information and coordination between the use of force coordinators, the SIC IOD coordinators, the pursuit coordinators, and the safety officers, that it's consistent throughout the organization ultimately. Mm-hmm. So we think that that's a good way to start. We know that there will be things that we need to be flexible and be prepared to change as the data comes in and as we see what works and what doesn't. So as we mentioned before, the in our quarterly reports, we wanted to talk about specific areas, and as Mr. Olicon said, this is a good opportunity to discuss work-related injuries.
Before we do that, Mr. Himes, do we want to go back? I may have jumped a few slides and have Captain Choi talk a little bit more about the Risk Management Division.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'd just like to tell you a little bit about the structure within Risk Management Division. We have the commanding officer, myself, and then the administrative staff, which is just my adjutant. But in the analysis and evaluations unit, we have two police performance auditors and a police officer 3 assigned to that section. And their primary role is to gather data, do the analysis, identify trends, and work with the problem-solving teams to come up with solutions and interventions. So that's where we get really focused on specific issues that we want.
Can you give one specific?
For example, if we see a significant focus area being strains or sprains within an IOD injury,
okay.
that analysis and evaluation unit would gather all the data from the systems that exist in other places, work with the problem-solving teams who have developed expert teams, both internally and externally, meet regularly, develop some solutions, interventions, and then push those out to whatever entities would be most impacted, and then we monitor those to see their effectiveness. So that would be an example. But until we can process that data and refine it, we're not at that stage yet. So that's what that section would do. And then under operations section, we have the REMAX support unit, which is a risk management executive committee. They essentially put together the profiles for the committee to review in making determinations on whether somebody's to remain or conclude from REMAC. And then we have our investigations unit. This is somewhat still in the development stages. Ultimately, what we'd like is to have a team that's able to respond after critical incidents and make an assessment regarding risk. So currently we have FID that goes out to category use of forces, and they're investigating the shooting, and they have a specific purpose and a mission for doing that. We have MCIT, Major Collision Investigation Team, that goes to major traffic investigations. They're recreating the traffic incident to see who the primary fault is. But we don't have anybody that goes out there to these incidents and looks at risk. Where are we going to be at as an organization for this incident a year from now? Is there liability? Is there something we could have done to have prevented this? Is there some training that needs to be rolled out to address this issue early on? That's what this unit hopefully will develop into. That's our desire. And then lastly, the mitigation unit, we talked about that. We have four problem-solving teams. They will be developing their expert teams and coming up with solutions or interventions on their focus areas with the assistance of the analysis and evaluation section.
At the end of the year, you're fortunate in that there's a monetary graph that says, hey, whatever it is, here's what we spent. Here's what we spent the money on. And so it basically prioritizes, I think, am I right in saying it helps you prioritize where you can save the most in injuries and money and everything else.
Absolutely. On those three harms that we talked about, financial, physical, and organizational.
Yeah, right.
So these teams actually have to come to me and do a presentation of why they want to focus on a particular area.
Yeah, good.
And they have to weigh those harms versus the other harms and convince me that
it's deployment. It's basically deployment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We want to spend our resources wisely. So.
I just wanted to mention one thing that Mr. Himes and Captain Choi, that I mentioned before. Oftentimes in a large organization, the idea is just create another division and have them do all the things that are necessary to address an issue. And as we know, we are a decentralized organization in large part because we are so vast and large and spread out. So that's why it was important to have this aspect of the area risk management coordinators, because Captain Choi's team could come up with the greatest idea in the world about reducing harm, but if we don't have the structure in place in each of the divisions to actually implement it, it's of limited use. And by retooling some of the existing resources in the Office of Operations and also looking at supplementing them to have a single point of contact, that risk management coordinator, not just looking at risk in general, but the four areas of the greatest concern and our focus will help do that, as well as better coordination, somebody looking at these issues. Captain Choi alluded to the fact that we do a lot of investigations, and very good ones, whether it's traffic collision or use of force. However, they are looking at it for those purposes. We need people looking at things for a broader purpose of prevention, safety, risk, etc.
Are the risk management coordinators collecting data? Is that part of their responsibility in order to identify issues and problem areas, patterns, or are they actually managing risk? So implementing the strategies.
I think it will be both, and the folks that assist the risk management coordinators. So if you look at the SIC IOD, use of force, etc., in many divisions there are individuals who are designated with those responsibilities, a SIC IOD coordinator. So by putting them all under the same supervisor, it enables them to do the tracking, et cetera, and most importantly, using the data. And we'll talk a little bit about one of the challenges that we have in the work-related injury issue is that the actual usability of the data, its integrity, and actually using it to make these interventions. So the answer would be yes, as well as the coordination. But the analysis and evaluation section is intended to look at it department-wide, and also help support the area divisions where we see some anomaly or we find that there's something that needs attention.
How are the initial divisions chosen?
Do you want to talk about the pilot program?
Just a handful right now?
Certainly. We looked at, for pilot purposes, we looked at both a geographic basis where it would be easier for us to do, so Operation Central Bureau is a good one to start. The other one we want to look at, because it's a little different policing, because we are, diverse throughout the city, we want to look at the Valley Bureau. Picking the actual divisions will be done in conjunction with both from a data-driven basis on, what we think we can impact, and then also in conjunction with the bureau chiefs and the operations chief.
And will risk management coordinators be appointed to each division area after you have a sense of what kinds of skills are required or the exact responsibilities of what more specific responsibilities of the coordinator? Is that after that is
I can answer that. Yes, we're currently working on specific guidelines and requirements that are necessary to hold that position and what our expectations are for that coordinator and who they're supposed to report to and what timeline they're supposed to make these reports and the follow-up and on specific actions taken. So that'll all be written down in some form of document, and that'll be used hopefully as a guideline to select those coordinators.
Mm-hmm. So this is all too new then to determine.
Yes, but we're in active conversations with Office of Operations to fill a few of those spots initially. What we'd like to do is see how it works, package it up, and have a nice thorough outline of how it's supposed to work before we roll it out wider.
Yeah, although it's new, which I think is important, I think your successes and your failures are going to come quickly. You're going to identify something, you're going to come up with a solution, you're going to implement it, and then see if it has an effect or not. And I'm interested in the success stories and the failures, as large or small as they may be, because I think that needs to happen. Like you say, you're ready for action, and I think that there should be a lot of them in the next 12 months.
And I think the benefit of actually starting in a few divisions enables us to do exactly going.
I look forward to hearing that.
You might address it as the report goes on. So just so that I understand, right now we are reorganizing and making structural changes, so we haven't actually implemented any of the strategies. And when will we begin?
So in terms of the structural changes, the Risk Management Legal Affairs Group and most of the staffing for Captain Choi's staff are in place. As of DP5, I believe most of the people have been transferred over. All of those groups have been actively working with other people in the department and elsewhere, looking at forming the expert groups and other things, and we've constantly been doing the analysis necessary to do that. So we are implementing the strategy and building the infrastructure, which in some ways was sort of distributed, and we're starting at a very early stage. But what we're hoping with is to get more into the tactical aspects to actually come up with solutions. So we're building toward that.
We're not there yet.
No.
Okay.
No. This is 8 weeks after the unveiling of it, so I think we've made some very rapid movements, especially with the organizational structural change that usually takes much longer, but with the chief's emphasis.
If I go back a year and just bring up one thing, seatbelts, okay? We knew that there were, that if everybody was wearing their seatbelts, we'd be spending, there'd be less injuries and less money spent. So that was a priority. Chief put it out as a priority. You merchandised it. Do you have measurable results from that yet? Or no?
We have some, and I probably have to defer to the Office of Operations that conducts the inspections of that, but that is one thing we're looking at. One thing that's very promising from our discussions with Motor Transport is the telematics system.
Mm-hmm.
With the cars, you can actually reliably know if a seatbelt was being worn, especially at certain speeds.
Mm-hmm.
In preliminary, we've seen a fairly high compliance rate. Now, that, of course, needs to be expanded throughout the city. My group is not in a position to say whether we've seen an improvement or not. One of the things we are looking at, though, and we'll have more data perhaps in the next meeting on traffic collisions, is seatbelts being worn in traffic collisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, because obviously the injuries could be much more severe if they're not.
But even the one thing that you mentioned, is that a result of this, the technical, where you'd be able to know if a seatbelt is on?
That's part of the telematics program that's been in process, and the pilot program that's currently ongoing.
Okay.
So why are we focusing on work-related injuries? Well, obviously it covers all three of the harms, but in particular something we knew some time ago, and it's illustrated in our report, is that the actual financial, organizational, and obviously the physical cost of work-related injuries is high. In fact, it's much higher, as you can see from this bar graph. That when you look at the costs associated and payouts for uses of force, employment litigation, and employee-involved traffic collisions. Now, this includes all civilian and sworn. The civilian costs are about 10% of what you see, a little bit less than that. But the important thing to remember is the total cost that's often put out, and it's in the controller's audit and sometimes quoted, is the total cost of actual financial payments associated with an injury for medical costs, medical expenses. I'll give a breakdown in just a second, but also salary continuation costs. So in other words, paying the officer or the civilian employee while at home recuperating from an injury and while they get their salary. So that's essentially a fixed cost we'd be paying them whether they're at home or at work, but obviously we don't have them available at work to work and perform their missions.
Does it include litigation settlements and things like that?
Yes, it would include the payments that occur, especially once somebody leaves or gets a payment as determined by the workers' compensation laws for future injuries, a sort of payout. Is included in this. And also one thing to keep in mind, we looked at 6 years worth of data.
Yeah.
So it's covering a longer time and noticing some of the trends for
but
that.
But like, for example, the use of force number, 45 million, so you've got 2014, 6 years, so, you know, $8 million a year or whatever. Is it,
those are litigation payouts.
Litigation payouts,
yes.
To the victim.
To the plaintiffs in the lawsuits, yes.
And those numbers, I mean, it seems like a different world now. People are going in for totally different kinds.
Yeah, and those are basically based, those are all focused on the litigation payouts and those costs. In this bar chart, we don't quantify other costs to the organization, et cetera. This is a purely financial analysis.
Yeah, no, that's what's interesting to me.
And the salary continuation cost is a good measure of the organizational harm, that we essentially lose about $122 million worth of time that people can contribute in working over the course of 6 years. So I think I know Commissioner Stilbrough, you're calculating something. Can I move to the next slide, or would you like me to wait? So this is essentially.
I parked your ticket last week. I was trying to figure out how much it's going.
Oh
no, I get it. I'm just trying to get to how much we're actually spending on these risk management issues as a result of them. on an annualized basis.
And I apologize, as I was driving in this morning, I realized we probably should have put it annualized. We had grouped it into the 6 years to get an understanding over the trend. But if you divide any of these by six, you would get that number.
Yeah.
This is a breakdown of all the work-related injury costs. So this answers your question, Commissioner Sobroff, of the breakdown. So you have the salary continuation, and this is just sworn. The other one had both sworn and civilian. But the medical expenses, so paying for medical costs, doctors, ambulances, is about $92 million, and those are actual dollars in expenditures. The payouts for permanent disability or temporary disability are the two next, the 47 and the 7. And then other types of expenses, there could be vocational training and those types of things that are required under law. And once again, this is over the course of a six-year trend.
This cost for work-related injuries, is that consistent with other law enforcement institutions, and relative to scale, as well as other institutions that are high risk of physical for physical injury? Or?
So what we found is it's actually quite difficult to compare to some other law enforcement agencies simply because their data and the availability of that data is limited. In the controller's audit, which we'll get to in a second, they do try to make some comparisons, but it was based on data that was provided by those agencies, Anaheim, Fresno, Long Beach, I believe San Diego. And there were some obvious gaps in what they provided. So for example, some of those agencies indicated to the controller's office that they had absolutely no strains or sprains as IOD claims. Now, a lower back strain is a presumptive injury, and it would be difficult to believe that a law enforcement agency so large would not have any claim, worker compensation claims. So that may just may be a gap in what they reported. So there's a challenge. We have done some preliminary analysis comparing to the Sheriff's Department in total payouts, but I think it's something we definitely need to look at so we can benchmark ourselves. But I think, as you can obviously see, as everybody else, there's a significant room for improvement regardless of how we compare to other departments.
I guess I'm more curious about the salary continuation cost, because if that's just mandated as part of our workers' compensation plan, then that's something that would be difficult to reduce unless there's prevention on the front end for injury in the first place.
I think there are two ways. As you referred to, under California state law, police officers and firefighters are entitled to 1 year of full salary when on a workers' compensation claim. In addition, there's supplemental insurance, and then they move to what's called the state rate, which is about 75% of their cost, and it's also tax-free, which is one of the major sort of structural disincentives to returning to work.
Right.
Now, the vast majority of officers want to get back to work, and for those, part of what we're doing and working in concert with the personnel division, return to work is looking at how we can streamline that process so those who do want to return to work can do so more quickly. That would minimize the salary continuation costs associated with that. So I just wanted to summarize the key findings, then I'll turn it over to Captain Choi, who will talk about some of the specific things we're doing on workers' compensation. But this is some of the key findings in the controller's report. It's a fairly lengthy report, and we just tried to pick out a few to show how we had either adopted what they were recommending or also just we have things in progress. The first thing that I think was important that we emphasized to them in working with them is that the department has actually been very successful in preventing serious bodily injury and death, which obviously are the highest priorities. And that is done by constant and consistent emphasis and training and messaging about officer safety and the safety of the public, whether it's in any field contact, uses of force, traffic collisions, et cetera. And they recognize that that was something that was working quite effectively. And recognizing that we need to take some of those concepts and apply them to other less serious injuries. And by doing so, that we have a higher probability of preventing those injuries. The second thing that was interesting, and this comes into play in terms of the fitness level and the participation of officers in the various fitness activities in the department, they conducted a survey in which over 1,000 police officers responded. And in that, 74% of them indicated that they regularly participate in fitness activities and consider themselves physically fit. That's a fairly impressive percentage. Now, obviously, we can't necessarily extrapolate that to the 10,000, depending on how the sampling. It wasn't a sampling; it was a self-responding survey. But it is a fair, an impressive statistic, and also I think reflects sort of the culture of the LAPD and its long-standing history of being very committed to physical fitness, given the challenges and the threats that they face. The other three things that are key, and then I'll turn it over, are the need to implement some of the structural changes we talked about, the need to improve our communications and training on injury prevention and not just officer safety, and the need to improve our access, tracking analysis of both the claims that are being filed and how they're being filed and the time, et cetera, but also what was the nature of the injury, where was it caused, were there preventable, was it preventable, non-preventable, and some of the data deficits that we have in the current system. So with that, I'll turn it over to Captain Choi.
Okay. Regarding the structural changes, a lot of this we've already talked about, the creation of Risk Management Legal Affairs Group and Risk Management Division and the sections and units underneath there. And then also the risk management coordinators, making sure that we have an alignment with all the entities already at the division, such as the SIC and IOD coordinators, use of force, the person that monitors the traffic collisions. Those make sure they're all aligned and that they're getting the same information and implementing best practices and using the information that they're developing. One thing that we didn't talk about was the activation of divisional safety committees. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that each officer or employee that's assigned to the safety committee realizes that they are a member of that committee, that they're meeting regularly, and that a member of that committee is the IOD, one of the IOD coordinators, and then that they're working with the risk management coordinators to provide information to those commanding officers at the division where they can actively, proactively manage these risks, prevent things from occurring in the workplace. So those are the structural changes. Most are, well, about half are implemented and the other half we're working on. So.
And these were things that were pointed out in the audit that we were aware of and we're working to make sure we put those in place.
Are the costs, are the financial costs of this in our budget that we submit every year, or are they borne by something else outside of our budget?
Financial costs for workers' compensation for all city departments is outside of their
particular budget. And what about the other issues, the other on the bar chart?
The other costs associated with it?
No, I'm talking about you had use of force, you had et cetera, et cetera.
Litigation payouts are also outside of every department's budget. Now, I should correct myself. Salary continuation costs are in the department's budget
for
salaries.
Right, of course.
But any medical expense payments or other type of payouts are outside of the department's budget.
It's very helpful, guys.
And, regarding communications and training on injury prevention, we've identified a need consistent with the controller's audit to improve our messaging. You know, we always talk about crime. We talk about use of forces. Everybody knows a lot of detail about that stuff. But we don't talk a lot about prevention, injury prevention, and safety in the workplace. Tactics, yes, but safety in the workplace, not really. Some of the things that we're working with Office of Administrative Services and medical liaison specifically are the use of banners on the department's land system to have like a daily safety message that goes out, ensure that all the appropriate Cal OSHA postings are in the workplace, that we have motivational posters in the workplace about health and fitness, and also to make sure that the safety and injury prevention is a topic of discussion during our roll calls. So have it on the forefront of everybody's mind all the time. And then as far as training, we want to develop a supervisory training curriculum or course that will improve our accident and injury investigations. And I'll go into more about that in a second. And then also to ensure that our new structure with these risk management coordinators, IOD coordinators, safety officers, and other key risk management coordinators like our problem solving teams are having quarterly training. So they're sharing best practices. They're implementing new things all the time at their workplaces, locally at the divisional level, so that everybody can have similar results, hopefully positive. Okay, and then back to the accident investigations. Regarding the training curriculum, we'd ultimately like to be able to have our supervisors do an investigation and have that investigation be useful in a sense of being able to determine whether that accident in the workplace was preventable or non-preventable, whether they, you know, whether there was a root cause that can be determined, and if it was preventable, if there was action taken on that accident, was there something in the workplace that needed to be changed? Was there a hazard identified that needed to be addressed? And then hold these supervisors, risk management coordinators, and command officers accountable for the change. And then to have that same structure, the risk management coordinators and all the safety committees that identify these safety hazards, providing the information mm-hmm. to the CO for proper management. Good. And then lastly, the tracking access and analysis of claims data and injury data. Personnel department uses a system called IVOS, I-V-O-S, to track their data. Admittedly, it's not a risk management database. It's not used or created. It was not created for that purpose. Recently, Risk Management Division has gained full access to that system, so we can enter and get into all parts of that system. What we've identified is there's a lot of fields that are not mandated in that system, and if we feel if we can mandate them so whoever's inputting the data is forced to fill out certain information in these fields, it can be more useful in helping us carry out our strategies of being focused in an area and then coming with solutions. An example of that is like presumptive injuries. There's a box that you can check as presumptive, mm-hmm. and you don't need to, but it's not mandated. So you can complete it, not check it, and input that particular injury. Well, when you go to query or develop a report, you have, and you want to do a couple years worth of data, you have to go through and manually remove every single injury that is presumptive. So it doesn't filter the way it should filter because some fields are not populated. Another issue is there's a box that says, activity engaged in, meaning what were you doing at the time of the injury? That is not a mandated field, and several queries that we had didn't have that field populated. So if you mandate it, it would provide a lot more information in identifying a root cause and preventive measures. But if we can do that, and we are working with personnel department to do that, if we can do that, we can produce reports that are more meaningful in analyzing our claims and injury data. We can distribute those reports to our bureaus and then down to the geographic areas to address some issues. And then we will, meaning Risk Management Division, will continue to analyze our existing data. Now, this is working on it. Hopefully, we can get that corrected. But with our existing data, we'll continue to analyze our existing data to determine root causes of what we have, because we know we have to continue to move forward.
Okay.
And the important thing to note here is that the current system is a claims processing system. It is not tracking the nature of injuries, et cetera. And I'll just kind of go through this very quickly. This is the 6 years' worth of data that we were able to look at, which were produced by the IVOS system. But it has these very broad categories, multiple injuries, strains, and sprains, without the nature of what those strains and sprains were. Now, we do plan to focus on the biggest areas, which are the 68% of all expenditures, which are sprains, strains, and multiple injuries. But it's going to require us to do some sampling and then figure out what is the actual cause and where are they occurring, what the trends. This is also true with the causes of the injury. You have cumulative injuries that could be something that occurred over a number of years, twists, falls, etc. And the importance of us to actually take deep dives into this to actually figure out the root causes. So in addition to the data collection, on this is the page 2 of the CompStat profile. We currently do track risk management information as part of CompStat, and commanding officers are asked about it. However, as you can see, they tend to be sort of aggregate information on sick hours, IOD hours, and various things, which doesn't enable a very meaningful analysis of what may be happening at a particular division except for what the gross number is. And being able to provide additional data on how many claims were filed, what types of claims, what were the causes, were they preventable, non-preventable injuries, will be very useful so that the division commanders can actually do something about these ongoing trends. And then just to summarize in terms of the timeline, as I presented on February 17th, we've obviously presented the report. The major thrust in the beginning was the activation of the infrastructure in terms of my team with the Legal Affairs Group and Risk Management Legal Affairs Group, as well as standing up the Risk Management Division. We have the problem-solving teams in terms of the staffing for each of the four areas. We are putting as the priority the workers' compensation, work-related injuries, and adjusting some of the staff on that, as well as analyzing that data and working with other groups. We plan to have the expert group, which is the others who are interested throughout the department, to contribute. And I should say, in terms of the reaction, I was very pleased that when we did announce vacancies for our division, we had overwhelming responses by officers and other personnel to want to come in. And I think not a day goes by when Captain Choi gets a call and says, hey, how can I help, and do you have any spots available? Which I think is a very good sign, because the enthusiasm of the workforce is going to be very important to make these difficult changes. So we hope to have that expert group formed and meeting within the next 2 weeks, especially as we analyze more of the data. And then following with the expert groups on the other days, because we want to make sure, in the following days. And then working on the actual solutions to get to an executive committee that will be formed to make decisions on what types of interventions that we should put in place. I do just want to mention that this does not mean, because our focus is on work-related injuries, that we are not working on parallel tracks in the other areas. We are, especially with workplace conflict and employee-involved traffic collisions, but our primary focus and the resources are really focused on the work-related injuries. At the next meeting for a quarterly report, we can, if the commission agrees, present more detailed information on what we're doing on employee-involved traffic collisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with that, we're happy to take
any other questions. We need to move on.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Well, I just really comment that the structural changes might appear like it has a consequence of increased bureaucracy, but it seems so thoughtful, your approach, and clearly you put in so much hard work that that. Yeah, I know that it's not. It's just
thank you.
Unnecessary bureaucracy. Yeah. Yeah.
The intent was not to move the boxes around.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming
here,
guys.
Thank you. We do have one public comment card. We have Terry Wilburn.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, commission, and all the staff. My thing is... just to pass a bill or mandate for funding, the back injuries or any other occurrence towards the police officers, it's a data that they prevent by the fugitives that breaks in a home and present it to the board, as well as on the final call in Scottsville, just recently, an officer was paid, put on your uniform, to attack this person right here and shoot him in the back, and then turn around and drops a stinger. On that pavement, our officers are being trained to not to drop any weapons or pay by any citizen to do the dirt or illegal crimes. On the other data, for payment, most officers are murdering other officers, like the chief of police who was in Oakland, for Kashana Watson, paying them to murder Bruce Lee's son. Then turn around, they gather themselves. But that's not just the point, that's a use of force. The other things, your adaptation to this bill. You must look at it because it's going too far.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Thank you. We're now on item 8B, Department's verbal presentation and discussion relative to the responsibility and service provided by the Crisis Response Support Section.
Thanks for your patience, everybody.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
My name is Kelly Moldorfer, and I'm the Commanding Officer of Detective Support and Vice Division. And within that division is the Crisis Response Support Section. And that's why we're here today, to kind of talk about, highlight some of the accomplishments and responsibilities of that unit and where we're going in the future, some of our future strategies. Just to give you a little bit of an outline of how it's structured, the Crisis Support Response Section has within it the Mental Evaluation Unit, which has our SMART CARS, which stands for the System-Wide Mental Assessment Teams. Those are our co-deployed response teams. We're co-deployed with Department of Mental Health clinicians, and Lieutenant Garcia will go into the details of that a little in a moment. MU, the Mental Evaluation Unit, also has a triage desk where officers call in to get advice on handling calls for service that involve mentally ill community members. And then we have within the Mental Evaluation Unit also a training cadre that provides all the department-wide training to our officers with regards to our response to mental health issues. And then also within the Crisis Response Support Section is the Threat Management Unit. And we'll go into some detail about what it is that they do as well. I'd like to introduce my leadership team for that section. First of all, we have Lieutenant Lionel Garcia, who is the current officer in charge of the CRSS. However, he's going to be retiring in about a week. So we have his replacement, Lieutenant Brian Bixler, who is the new OIC, effective in a couple weeks from now.
Thursday.
Yeah, right. Okay. We've also brought Detective 3 Jeff Dunn. He is the officer in charge of the Threat Management Unit. We have Detective 3 Paul Shiri, and he's in charge of our CAMP unit, which I forgot to mention, the Case Assessment and Management Program, and Lieutenant Garcia will explain all of what they do. We also have Detective 3 Charles Dempsey, who is in charge of our training cadre. And also here is Mr. Chuck Lennon, who is the program head for our law enforcement teams at Department of Mental Health. He's our partner at Mental Evaluation. So with that, I will turn it over to Lieutenant Garcia to go into detail.
Lionel, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Nice to see you come, but sorry to see you go.
Yeah, it's going to be tough, but time to go, I guess. Mm-hmm. But thank you for having me here on the eve of my retirement. It's next. My last day is next Thursday. And I've been a member of the department for 32 years. I've served in the capacity of a lieutenant for 16 and a half years. And I've served as the officer in charge of my section for the past 7 years. And during that time, we've achieved a great number of things within the operation. I was assigned there in early 2008 by Chief Gary Brennan, who asked me to take over the MEU to accomplish a few things. I was supervising the threat management unit at the time, so my arrangement was I was to take the threat management unit with me because I felt that would be a great merger, and it has. It's been one of the most successful mergers or department realignments in the history of the organization. It's very unique. They have very unique strategies that they engage in to problem solve, case manage. So what you have there is a very unique operation within the CRSS consisting of the TMU and the MEU. Their agency across the country trying to emulate that strategy. They can't do it, or they're having difficulty trying to mesh the two, but we have done so successfully here. Given the cases that the threat management unit handles, stalking is one of their cases, workplace violence involving city departments, aggravated threats, and threats against city elected officials. So a lot of their cases are confidential, so we can't discuss them, of course, but very serious investigations, very complicated over the past 7 years, and not a lot of them result in arrests. Because of the partnership, a lot of the individuals are dealt with on the mental health side. So that's a very unique strategy we have going for us here on the department. Many of the stalkers and those such of cases, workplace violence, involve persons who are suffering from mental health crisis. So rather than pursue arrests for those cases that we can, we pursue the mental health issues. And we repatriate them to other countries where they've come from, because they're stalking celebrities from other countries, and we'll work with the other countries to get them repatriated back to their country via the mental health side. We send nurses with them. We hand them off on the other side to ambulances and other doctors and nurses. They're placed in hospitals. And so very unique strategies we have going for us in the TMU. The TMU, over the years, have engaged as a co-partner with the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals, otherwise known as ATAP. It's an annual conference, international conference, held here in Anaheim, California. And as partners, we ensure that topical issues are discussed, that we're participants in those discussions, and we draw anywhere from 800 to 1,000 folks that attend this conference. The association stemmed from the LAPD in the mid-90s. Prior lieutenant created that organization once the LAPD created the threat management team here in the LAPD. In 2012, Detective Dunn participated as an internationally known expert in threat assessments with the Department of Defense, a task force to review violent behaviors stemming from the DOD Fort Hood shooting on November 5th. The effort resulted in the publishing of the report, DOD Defense Science Board Task Force on Predicting Violent Behavior, August 2012. Now, that expertise, they sought it from us because our folks are well attuned to what's going out there. They stay at the cusp of the issues. So Detective Dunn provided a significant amount of expertise to that committee, and he brought a lot of things back with him, which has enabled us to better handle workplace violence cases and cases involving targeted school violence. Later this year, Detective Dunn has been invited to participate in the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit Threat Assessment Active Shooter Symposium, July 26th through the 28th in Charlottesville, Virginia. The goals of this small select group are to identify operationally relevant strategies for the detection and disruption of persons who appear to be on a path to attempt an active shooting, to guide future research of thwarted disrupted acts, highlight investigative strategies that foster a greater understanding of the elements of both thwarted and completed attacks, and generate the framework for best practices, FBI monograph, that will inform K-12 through university and workplace threat management efforts. Again, Jeff takes with him a lot of knowledge and insight because we deal with targeted school violence and workplace violence cases. So once he's involved in that task force, he will bring back additional information which will further aid us in our investigations and our ability to handle these critical incidents. So the TMU is well suited to move forward into the future based on the knowledge they have, the knowledge they will gain as they continue to interact with outside agencies globally, because we get calls every day from agencies from all over the world trying to solicit from us ideas and strategies and concepts and assistance and how they can better perform within their organizations. So the TMU is to be considered an outstanding operation, and we should be very proud of it. The MEU has become a national model. I am referred to as the department's mental illness project coordinator. As the mental illness project coordinator, I'm responsible for ensuring that I identify training needs, that we design training relative to our needs, that identify and review department procedure, that we establish appropriate procedure for us to follow within this department, and that we carry out training. So identify training, develop training and implement the training, mental illness training. That falls on my shoulders per the consent decree.
To the two officers?
All officers.
I mean, this is probably as important an issue, I hate to do it so late in the agenda,
yes,
as ever comes up to us, because this is the trending issue, and you look nationally, and virtually every single situation has some sort of mental illness as part of it, and the training of the officers is, you know, seems many times to be lacking. And so, you know, my question is, how do we do in taking what you've learned and getting it into these programs? You know, there were 19 that you saw just graduate. Are they getting? It seems to be such an evolving thing. Do you teach classes at the for the cadets and continue to update?
As I stated, my role is to identify training, to create the training, and to host the training, to put it on. That's the role given to me by the consent decree.
At the academy?
Well,
at the training academy? Or your house?
No. Yes. Yes and no. There are others that control where we can conduct this training. We have designed training courses for the officers in service.
Well, here's my bottom line question here. Are our officers being trained as well as they should be trained based on all the input that you're getting in mental evaluation unit? You guys are known around the country,
sure,
as knowing your stuff. Of course, I'm concerned that everybody else is coming to you to get advice for them. But I'm really also concerned about, you know, we're paying you,
sure,
to give advice to our cops.
Right.
And are our people getting the kind of training, or do you feel that there's more to go in that way? And is there anything that we can do about it? Because, I mean, this sounds like a critical issue here.
Sure. There's always room for growth, but our officers are getting the training that they're supposed to be getting, that they should be getting, mm-hmm, all of them. And we, over the years, we've used various formats. We've used conferences where we've taught target school violence. We've taught autism awareness. We've taught PTSD, TBI.
Is that those 30-hour courses that people were talking about?
No. These conferences, eight full-day conferences over a couple years. We've also published e-learning courses that every officer had to view, various time frames, 3 hours, 4 hours, 2 hours. Over the years, we've had several courses. We started with a CIT 40-hour course, a 24-hour course, 8-hour courses, crisis communication. We trained all of South Bureau a couple years ago in crisis communication all at once, over about a two-month period. Presently, we created a 36-hour course, which actually translates to a 40-hour course. There are other courses that they take. But it's a 36-hour post-approved course. It was approved last year. That course has, according to Post, is second to none in the state of California.
How many of our officers have taken it?
So far, we've had approximately, about 300, almost 300 take that course. We had 25 per class. We started last July.
So I want to take that class. Okay? I'm reading in the paper every day. This is a skill set that's needed. You heard about it on Skid Row. You can't go any place in LA where it isn't needed. Okay, I mean, every officer should,
sure,
also be a Dr. Phil. Okay, they have to be.
As we speak, that.
So I want it. So where do I go to sign up for it?
That course is offered to every police station in the city. So we send out a correspondence advising of our course.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, as we speak, the course is ongoing. It started this morning. And right, they should,
okay,
be in there.
How long do I have to wait to get in there? I mean, do you have
the, we have a waiting list,
power and the fund? You don't. Okay. You have a waiting list.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, a course only accommodates 25 persons per post.
Yeah.
Right, once a month per post. Mm-hmm. So right now, even if we wanted to run it twice or 10 times a month, we cannot, because Post only permits once a month. Next year, we're going to try to solicit for additional courses, permission to teach additional courses, but it's up to POST, what POST allows. So we have to keep the classes at 25 because of the learning modules and what have you. So we would like to expand that course and offer it several times a month, but with that we would need a larger cadre. It takes us about 12 to 15 persons to manage this course, to include the county clinicians that we use as instructors to aid us. So the county clinicians, they have their own mission, and the county would prefer them in the field serving the community, not teaching in the class. But I'm able to get them into this course to teach, and then we, once their class is over, we send them back to the field and they get back to work. But we can work out arrangements with the county so that we can make more use of the personnel if and when we can expand the number of courses we can offer. So what we do is we send out notifications to every area in the city advising of the upcoming course. They select the most appropriate officers based on the need of the area. So we trained all of the Venice Beach folks. We're training 15 officers from Central in every course. We're running every SEI officer through that course since last year. So each area identifies those officers who come in contact most often with persons who are suffering from a mental health crisis, and they send those folks through. So that's just one course, but we know we cannot get everybody through that course, and the prevailing philosophy nationwide is that you should not put everybody through that course. The philosophy is the course should only be given to those who volunteer to take the course. You shouldn't force them to take the course, and or that they have some association with those persons who are mentally ill. Now, it's not a bad thing to send everybody through the course. It's not. We just, with 10,000 officers, it's kind of impossible, right? So we would like to achieve a percentage of each area to train. So we have percentages of officers in each area that have been trained in this extensive 36-hour course. And then the other officers are trained in 8 hours, 4 hours, and a compilation of different types of courses that will aid them in having a better understanding of how to interact with persons suffering from mental health crisis. So we layer the training to ensure that everybody gets hit at some segment or another. So in the academy, they start out with the academy post-training course, and they graduate into the field, and then it's a series of in-service courses that they would attend, whether it's e-learning or whether it's in-classroom or conference, like I've stated, conference settings. So there's various levels that we've achieved. Other departments don't do that. In this county, there is no agency that does this, just us. And so other agencies primarily run a 40-hour course and that's it. Or they don't have the other multi-level strategies that we engage in here in the city on how to deal with persons who are suffering from mental health crisis. Here in this department, we do. Our officers are trained, and that's why our uses of force are very low relative to persons who are suffering from mental health crisis, 2.8% out of the 14,000 crisis calls we received last year. 2.8% resulted in use of force. And that's given the fact that here in this department, we document just about everything as being a use of force. If somebody says, ouch, that's essentially use of force, right? In other cities, they don't document as thoroughly as we do here in this city. And they're at 40%. The sheriff department's at 40%. They're at 40%, 60%, 50%. We're at 2.8%. Kudos to the officers who are responding out there and engaging with those persons in the field who are in crisis. Very low. So we ensure, because the SMART teams are not first responders, they're secondary responders. So because we have to rely on patrol to properly engage, we ensure that they're trained in various ways.
Chief Pasinger, your reaction to the importance of, you know, that you're a big believer in this and not...
Thank you, Mr. President. I think what Lionel has said thus far, it goes without saying, and actually it was echoed to a great degree by Officer Dion Joseph during his presentation. Much of what we do in the homeless community as a law enforcement agency really has nothing to do with policing, as much as some of these issues have to do with treatment and services. And largely, the support that MEU and the work that's being done in that domain has done for the organization, and frankly for the city, had set a standard throughout the nation by which, in my belief, just about every law enforcement agency in the United States should be compelled to comply. To the question of whether or not there is a lot of additional work to be done,
yeah.
Absolutely, just in terms of it, the training, the applications of the various principles, some of the things, the creative things that we have done, largely Lionel and his team, have done over the years is extraordinary work. But the problem is broad, the problem is deep, and it calls for an involvement by other city departments, in addition to the elected officials, to get our arms around a problem that has ramifications that go far beyond the city of Los Angeles and stretches across these United States.
You know, I'd like to, we have to wind up because we have some closed session stuff, but I'd like you guys to come back. Lionel, you won't. I mean, it's a public meeting.
Sure.
You have to just go through the machines out there.
And get scanned
and all that
in.
Stuff. But we'd like to have you come back. But I'd like to hear about the progress every 6 months or so from you guys, because this is where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is drive around and see. This is a hugely important.
Sure.
Does anybody have any other questions? I know we're. Anything else you need to say today that we can't?
Jackie, Lisa.
I'd like to see you guys back here regularly, frankly.
Yes, sir. There's a lot that we're doing relative to this issue, training being one component of what we do. Certainly the strategies to respond to these crisis calls and deal with the number of calls that we're dealing with the size of the cadre that we have to work, incredible. Outstanding work that they're doing, and the work we're doing with District Attorney Jackie Lacey.
Yep.
She's relying on us for expertise to help model her strategies. But with that, we're certainly open to come back, surely, and demonstrate what we do. Yeah. We did have a presentation for you this morning, but I know you're running short of time.
But I just hope, you know, I just want you to be a squeaky wheel, you know,
sure.
Because you have needs, you have observations. Is the training going well? Are there recommendations you can make as far as your resources go? Because this is a really important factor. Thank you, guys, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now on item number 9, public comment period. We have 4 public comment cards. So we have Ted Hayes, Prentice Jenkins, Mr. Herman, who is not here, and Terry Wolburn.
Okay, let's go.
First of all, I might talk about this train. Let me give you something and get a general concept of how the average person would look upon this about the Crenshaw Line train. There's going to be a train stop at the Baldwin Hills Plaza. I hope you're all familiar with that location. One block away. One walking block away. There's another train stop at Lamert Park. Well, Lamert Park is unusual because it's not a city-owned park. It's still owned by the Lamert family. But that train stop at Lamert Park is going to cost $120 million. Nowhere in the Red Line system is there a train stop one block away. And the train stops that are close to one another, there are always 40 and 20, 30-story buildings at those stops. Lamert Park is currently a homeless encampment. The shopping carts are there. Even tents are out there. So why would the politicians, the board of supervisors, and the mayor, which is 3 people on the metro board, put a train stop one block away and charge us $120 million? Most people think that's kickback, corruption, graft. And that's what I think. So that's why I'm talking about this train thing, because it's loaded with pork, kickback, and corruption. Not only that, the darn thing's going to take 7 years to build. If the Chinese were building it, they start at both ends and the middle and work out and get it done in 1 year. So it's going to create jobs, right? but it's also going to squander $120 million needlessly. And this is corruption, and this is what our transit system is in Los Angeles.
Prentice Jenkins.
I'm obsessed with the unattainable, and because of that, I must eliminate the unattainable. Robert Bardo, the man who shot Rebecca Schaefer to death. She didn't know he was stalking her. For 2 years he was. I videotape everywhere I go, and I put it on the internet. So if I accidentally get hit by a fire truck, it'll be on the internet, and it'll be out to stop watching all the other organizations that watch the cops. The reality is this. You had a threat assessment unit here, but they won't investigate their own. And actually, 1% of the time, it's the cops. 99% of the time, it's those crazy firemen. Let me ask you, was Dorner crazy 2 weeks before he did what he did? Was he crazy a month before he did what he did? He was crazy for a long time. It's just when he started shooting, you all recognized that he was crazy. But he'd been crazy for a long time. And so was those Columbine killers. Were they crazy 2 weeks before they did what they did? Yes, they were. So it doesn't matter that they ain't hit me yet or that they're upset because I won't let them give me mouth-to-crotch resuscitation because that's what they want. The reality is this. You folks need a sub-commission of people made up of us. That's what you need. Because you're not out there. You live in the suburbs, all of you. So how the heck you know what's going on Skid Row? How would you possibly know what's going on Skid Row? You need us as a subcommission. And that's like you telling me, I found the gay cop, Jim Parker, a sergeant. That's like you guys telling me there's only one prostitute on Figueroa and Vernon. There are more gay cops on the down low, and he deserves to have a job.
Terry Wilburn.
I have a several things. First of all, this committee who is training on my ranches, and they have documentations for those ranches there. They are great trainers. Even the military says that in Chicago, in the boot camp, and what have you. But the thing is, their mental capability of racism, all right, because they come from Woodland, and they trying to involve themselves throughout the world through the various officers and badges that people pass to them. Now, in this case, the Pope got jumped on, both Pope. In this case, Sixth Army got jumped on by these same officers. All right? IPB got jumped on by having one of my response. And the president got shot that year. You should recall yourself. It was a good shot. But the thing is, the forces and the crimes are being committed. You need to look into that, even your own self and staff, when in fact there is money involved. And other human beings.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are no other public comment cards. We're now on item number 10, and we do have one comment card for 10C before we recess. Mr. Jenkins, Prentice Jenkins.
How many times do I have to stand up here and say this to you folks? An investigation, Penal Code 646.9 says that anyone who maliciously and willfully follows a person, that's a stalker. That's a California law. Yet you folks will not investigate it. The police will not investigate the firemen. A threat assessment unit sat right there. As long as they're investigating people on the outside, they're fine. They won't investigate each other. And that's the truth. I have a right. It says if I have a reasonable threat, It's public comment, sir. If I have a reasonable threat, and what gets me is every time you hear something and you know it's the truth, your heads pop up like prairie dogs, and you start interrupting me. You know that's the truth, and the truth hits you in the heart. So the reality is the threat assessment unit won't investigate their own. I'm talking about investigating the Los Angeles Fire Department, yet they won't investigate them. Why? Because that's their brothers. So they're all right with that stalking, but one day someone's going to stalk your children. Some perv is going to sit outside your children's school, and you're going to be outraged. How dare he stalk our children? Someday one of you women are going to be stalked, or one of you men are going to be stalked, and you're going to be outraged. Guess what? Don't be outraged, because a threat to stalking someone anywhere is a threat to stalking someone everywhere. Just ask the Jews in Nazi Germany. Everybody thought, oh, you're just messing with the Jews. That's all right. 6 million people later, tens of thousands of Catholics dead. Remember they said? The Catholics didn't say anything about
the
Jews.
So out of line, so off base.
See, there you go. So you heard something that
goodbye.
Was true. You heard something that was true. And you interrupt. I only have 8 seconds left.
Good.
The Board of Police Commissioners will now recess into closed session to discuss item numbers 10A, B, and C in accordance with Government Code 54957.